Athens News Matters is sponsored in part by the WUGA Community Advisory Council, dedicated and involved individuals who help WUGA stay connected with our listeners, community organizations, and issues in the Athens area. Learn more at WUGA.org.
Today on Athens News Matters, in less than a month, Georgia lawmakers will be back at work drawing new maps for congressional, state house, and state senate districts. We'll talk about what to expect during the always contentious process of redistricting. This is Athens News Matters. I'm Alexia Ridley.
And I'm Chris Shoup. Also today, with over 80 proposed projects totaling nearly $700 million, the county's TSPLOST Advisory Committee has some tough choices to make in the coming months. We'll talk about what projects might make the final cut. Plus, it seems like Joro spiders are everywhere, and while some scientists say that's not necessarily a bad thing, others are worried.
Those stories, plus our panel recaps a busy and sometimes argumentative commission meeting.
Morning Edition goes to the source, to the people affected by the news.
This plant could shut down, and a lot of very good people could lose their jobs.
Like this, it's completely ridiculous that we should feel unsafe to go to school.
I'm Noelle King. For stories that matter to you, listen every weekday to Morning Edition from NPR News.
This is Athens News Matters from WUGA News. I'm Chris Shoup. Major intersection improvements, more hangars at Athens Benapps Airport, and lots of sidewalks and bike lanes. Those are just a few of the projects that could be on the ballot next May when Athens-Clark County voters will decide whether to approve TSPLOST 2023. Here to talk about what could make the list is WUGA's Martin Matheny, who has been covering this story for us. Thanks for joining me today, Martin.
Glad to be here.
So I want to start with kind of the 101 level. What exactly is TSPLOST?
Well, TSPLOST stands for Transportation Special Purpose Local Option Sales Tax. It's a 1% sales tax for transportation improvements. And there's also two kind of interesting things to me about TSPLOST, or really any kind of SPLOST. First of all, there's a confirmed project list before the voters vote on it at the polls, so they know exactly what their tax dollars are buying. And also, TSPLOST has an expiration date. So this TSPLOST, if the voters approve it, will run for a certain number of years or until it's collected a certain amount of revenue, whichever comes first.
Okay, well, let's talk about some of the projects that stand out to you then.
There are a lot of East Athens-related projects. Lighting, new streetlights. There's a project for drainage because there's some street flooding issues. There's a request for a speed enforcement and speed study, new signage, new markings. And the primary driver on this has been the East Athens Development Corporation. They submitted a number of potential projects that will help out East Athens. And that's been sort of a consistent complaint in the county, both in terms of how SPLOST revenue is spent, because we've been doing SPLOST and TSPLOST for decades now.
Sure.
And also just in terms of general spending is that certain areas of town get overlooked in favor of more affluent areas. So seeing a lot of East Athens projects on this potential list of projects is, I think, a really good thing. Another thing that really stood out to me is a focus on intersections, and that's both from residents and from county departments. So one of the intersections that is the subject of a project is Tallahassee Road, where there's that stretch where it goes past Forest Heights Drive, then Loop 10, then Mitchell Bridge Road. Transportation and Public Works wants to spend some money and redo that intersection. Another one, and I think this was a citizen-submitted project, is the intersection at Timothy Road, Mitchell Bridge, and Atlanta Highway. That's one of the most crash-prone intersections in the county. And then finally, there are a number of projects, as you would expect in Athens, having to do with Athens Transit. One thing that Athens Transit is asking for is a new building, a new operations center. Their current one dates back to, I believe, 1976. It was originally built to support a fleet of 16 buses. Right now, Athens Transit operates 32 buses, as well as another 20 or so support vehicles, vans, things like that. And they're also part of a multi departmental proposal to electrify the fleet, transitioning all of our buses and other sort of fleet vehicles over to being electric. And Athens Transit and the other people on this proposal say it's going to save the county a good bit of money, several million dollars over 10 years, as well as cutting back on carbon emissions and particulate matter in the air.
So how about the airport? You know, one of my favorite airports is Greenville-Spartanburg. And every time I'm through that airport, I look around and I go, why can't we do this in Athens?
Well, one reason that it would be really hard to replicate Greenville in Athens is that Athens is in pretty close proximity to Hartsfield-Jackson.
Sure.
And to Greenville, for that matter.
Yeah, right.
So that sort of disincentivizes major airlines from wanting to fly in and out of Athens. A group of community and business leaders have been working for years on trying to restore passenger service that has sort of gone quiet since the pandemic in the last 18 months or so, but it is a high priority. They want to have at least one commercial carrier coming in and out of Athens. But that's less dependent on things that we can do with T-Splast and more dependent on what commercial airlines feel like they want to do that's in the best interest of their bottom line. It's sort of the opposite of Field of Dreams. It's not if you build it, they will come. It's if they come, we'll build it.
Okay. All right. Fair enough.
But the airport is actually putting the finishing touches on a big T-Splast project from before with a new runway and things like that. That project also assisted by around $10 million in state and federal funding to help out. Right now, the airport is asking for two things in this new T-Splast. The first is to build some new hangars that would be rented to private aircraft owners. Right now, Ben Epps has 77 hangars.
Wow.
Every one of them is full.
Is that right?
And there are 15 people on the waiting list.
Wow.
The airport estimates that building new hangars could bring in around $66,000 a year in rental fees and another $75,000 in fuel purchases. Mm. The other thing that the airport would like to do, and this struck me as a really interesting idea, the airport says we would like to build a trail around outside our perimeter fence. It'd be a little over 5 miles for walking and biking and could possibly connect to some of the other large trails here in Athens.
Interesting. Very interesting. So where are we right now in this whole process?
Right now we're in a very critical phase, and that is the public input phase. So we've got nearly $700 million of projects. The T-Splast Advisory Committee is going to have to make some really tough choices because T-Splast 2023 is expected to bring in $144.5
million. Wow.
So there's going to be a lot of selective work for them. Part of their process of winnowing this big list down is public input. And people in Athens Clark County can go to accgov.com/T-Splast 2023, and they can weigh in on these projects. I think if you live in Athens Clark County, you definitely want to go take a look at this and let your opinions be known.
Well, there you have it. Martin Matheny is our senior producer for news here at WUGA, and you can read his entire comprehensive article about T-Splast over on our website. Martin, thanks for sharing all that information with our listeners today.
Thanks for having me.
All Things Considered has been there through controversial wars.
Thousands of young people came to Washington.
National disasters.
Challenger, go with throttle up.
The explosion in the clear blue Florida
and breakthrough moments.
Just let it sink in. An African-American president of the United States of America.
4 decades of bringing you the news on All Things Considered every afternoon.
This is Athens News Matters from WUGA News. I'm Alexia Ridley. The mayor and commission had an eventful evening Tuesday with an over 3.5 hour long meeting. Now, we did see the passage of several projects that have been coming down the pipeline for some time. Among them, the commission approved more money for vaccine incentives, a public bathroom downtown, the creation of an alternative response team for mental health-related 911 calls, a disparity study to research whether minority-owned businesses are getting a fair share of ACC government contracts, and the purchase of hybrid police vehicles. So here to talk about that, plus the rest of the weekend news, are Chris Dowd with Athens Politics Nerd and Gwen O'Looney with WXAG. Obviously, guys, we are not going to be able to cover everything on the list, I don't think, that happened in that meeting. But let's start with what they're calling the Alternative Response Team. And Chris, I wondered if you could start out by giving us a little background about this and then discussing what happened in the meeting.
Okay. Well, this is actually related to the George Floyd protests of last year and sort of this, really nationwide demand to reimagine our police forces as, something that's less militarized, less violent force, and more of a positive force the way some people see it. And so this is an alternative to police. So this will be a three-person team. So it'll include a clinician, a medical professional, and a peer specialist who are going to directly respond to some 911 calls that police would have otherwise gone to. So I think it's really interesting, and it's just a trial program. So they're going to give it a try for a year, and they're going to focus on safety for the team as what their primary goal while they build confidence and kind of work out the kinks. And so they're going to provide, outreach to community members who are in need of help. They're going to give supportive counseling, and they're going to transport people to some different social service agencies. So I think it's a really positive thing. So this is not in any way defunding the police, but it is sort of reimagining the way we kind of view crisis response and emergency response.
Right. I think that Chris is right. This does not in any way reduce the police. It expands their efficiency and their effectiveness and gives them the opportunity to pull in the resources of the community when they're appropriate and avoid those situations that take a lot of time and require an expertise that we shouldn't expect from our police. I think that Chief Brule would be the first to say that this is a valuable addition to our police, not a defunding, but a true new vision of a better way of serving our citizens when they're in trouble. The dispatcher will not refer people to events that have weapons involved or that a crime is involved, but this is a way of allowing people to reach out to the police when they're experiencing mental health problems.
And you pointed out, Gwen, that they're only responding to nonviolent, non-criminal 911 calls. And they also will have some limited hours of operation. They are working Monday through Friday. But you do believe this team can still make a difference.
Right. They're only operating when social services and the resources that they might need to refer or transport people to are available. But they will be informed of calls that they received in their off hours that are appropriate for their intervention and attention.
Well, sticking with the commission, because basically so much was accomplished at that meeting, let's move on to the disparity study. And Gwen, maybe you could talk us through how government contracts work and why a study like this could be useful for determining whether they're being given out equitably.
Well, when I was mayor, we tried to implement a percent goal where we would then split our service contracts and others between minority and women-owned and other businesses that we wanted to assist. And now the federal government has said that what we were trying to do was illegal unless we proved that that these services were available, that they didn't cost the citizens more, et cetera. So this company is had a great track record. Anybody can look them up, but they're really going to do a full understanding of our community and use community minority or other businesses as they implement the study. So I'm I think that everybody will feel good about next steps taken when they have this kind of foundation of information and resources that are available.
Yeah, and the commission, you know, isn't excited about doing another study, especially one that cost $400,000. But yeah, as Gwen said, that it would be illegal to try to address this without doing this study. Like, we have to have evidence that there is a disparity there that needs to be addressed. And so that's why they're doing it.
Do you know some of the details of the study, what it would really entail?
Well, first of all, it's going to study those contracts that were given in the last year or so, or multi-year contracts. And then they're going to look at whether or not there were alternatives to those people that were funded or contracted with that were not looked at or talked to or whatever, and what kind of limitations or hindrances might have been involved. Some of these contracts that we do, for instance, our largest contracts, the most expensive thing we build is a jail. And when we did that, there were very few companies, national, they were huge companies that were used to doing jails. They had the complexity, they had the resources, et cetera. But one of the things that I believe is that they often have subcontractors for smaller aspects of large projects, and those will be studied to see if we can't better build capacity within our community.
Thanks for that explanation, Gwen. Let's move on to another item on the list at the commission meeting. Commissioners outline recommendations for how the next T-SPLOST money should be spent. Those recommendations include improvements to the Firefly Trail, College Plaza, a roundabout on West Broad and Hancock, money for electric vehicles, and many, many others. Do any of these projects stick out to you, or do you have any sort of pet projects of your own that you'd like to see approved?
So the ones that the commission are recommending to the advisory body, they're kind of in three different buckets here. So the first one is just things that are necessary that we just kind of have to do, like bridge improvements, pavement maintenance, and the culvert and live stream pipe replacement program. And then another bucket are things they kind of already made real commitments to. So like the West Broad and Hancock roundabout, they've already kind of said they're going to do that. And so they need some way to fund it. And the Firefly Trail, like, we've already, you know, completed two different segments. Like, we just want to connect those two segments. And then the College Square Plaza is something that, you know, yeah, we've already kind of, you know, cars can't go through there anymore, and we want to make it look nice, basically. And so that's going to be in there. And it'll be a real public square. I mean, I really support that project, honestly. Like, we need a public square. We don't have one right now. So I think it'll be really cool. And then the last bucket is to provide equitable transportation options and to help meet our 100% green energy commitment. And so that is going to be electrifying the local government's fleet of vehicles. They're going to buy a bunch of electric vehicles, and then money for transit operations just to fund our transit system for the next 5 years.
In the recommendation that was passed that Carol Myers and Melissa Link brought in together, they really stated the major things that are citywide, like bridges and culverts and repaving, those kind of things. But they also, I thought, were very careful about saying that they wanted equity, that they wanted it to be geographically provided in such a way that equity occurred. Ovita Thornton said something that really struck me. I have always complained because SPLOS, or any sales tax, is a regressive tax. And Ovita said that this is a regressive tax, but we can make it progressive if we just equalize that, we make up for some of the things that our blighted neighborhoods and our neighborhoods of the past that have not gotten services and amenities, that if we make improvements to those neighborhoods, it makes it a progressive tax. And I think that was a real important goal that the commission showed.
And I do want to point out that we, as we were discussing this, I said they made these recommendations, but the commission took pains to say these are recommendations, not designations. So that distinction, what does that distinction mean?
So it's been a little controversial about whether the commission should designate certain projects that are definitely going to be on the final TSPOS list, or whether they should just let everything up to the advisory committee to determine everything. But of course, you know, there are things that are the commission has already committed to that they have to fund and that they've been planning for a while to fund through TSPOS. And so the idea is that they just want to let the citizens committee know about which things that they've already committed to. And so that, I think that's why they're calling it kind of just recommendations, or they're really just trying to communicate to the advisory committee. And they don't want to call it designation, even though that's kind of what it is, because they want to see this as a kind of an open, ongoing conversation and not kind of like the end of the conversation.
You know, with 91 projects, they need some guidance as to far as what we actually need from this. I would immediately take out a lot of things that are normal maintenance. I have a lot of concern about some of the things that are on there are major matches to state improvements, like Hancock, West Broad and Hancock is a state road, and there's some money available there. The one that's out even farther up the Atlanta Highway. I have a lot of problems with us spending our money on state problems. I do agree with transit expansion, but I think we need to be very careful that we are doing that to assure an equity across our community. And we don't have that now. There's a huge number of projects on the North Avenue corridor, and there's a lot of projects on the East Athens area. I think those need to be grouped and looked at together as we approach those communities and look at all of the different proposals to see what their needs are. And they are great opportunities for us to improve the equity of our services and our amenities across the community.
Well, that's all the time we have for today. I do want to thank my panelists, Chris Dowd with Athens Politics Nerd and Gwen O'Looney with WXAG.
I'm Tim Franks. From the biggest breaking stories of the day to the important issues and trends, we're there.
This is an historic victory and what is a very important day.
This could change world history.
Everybody's going to pay a price. He will, everybody will.
And I am just so happy to be home and to put my feet on this land again.
Another huge development.
Join me and my colleagues for NewsHour from the BBC.
This is Athens News Matters. I'm Alexia Ridley.
And I'm Chris Shoup. Every 10 years, state lawmakers are tasked with redrawing congressional and state legislative districts in accordance with the new U.S. Census data. This process is called redistricting. It is a complicated and often contentious process, and one you're going to be hearing a lot about when lawmakers return to Atlanta early next month. Here to give us some insight is Georgia Public Broadcasting political reporter Stephen Fowler. Welcome back to Athens News Matters.
Always a pleasure.
Well, to start with, can you just give us a brief breakdown of what happens during redistricting?
Yeah, so our state lawmakers will reconvene and figure out how to redraw the district lines for Georgia's 14 congressional seats, 56 state Senate seats, and 180 state House seats. And they're going to have to figure out how to nip and tuck the boundary lines to account for Georgia adding about a million people over the last decade. And so the average district size is going to get bigger. And what that means is in places like South and Southwest Georgia, they're going to have to stretch a little bit farther to hit that population. And places like the Metro Atlanta area, the Metro Savannah area, Augusta, that means the district boundaries are going to get a little bit smaller because that's where the population growth is centered.
A proposed map of Georgia's new congressional boundaries has been released. What can you tell us about the map?
Yeah, so Georgia has the same number of seats as before, so we don't have to worry about adding or subtracting one. And the biggest change that this proposed map would do would take the 6th congressional district, currently represented by Democrat Lucy McBath, and change it from a slightly Democratic-leaning district to one that's a little bit more conservative. And to do that, because basically for every redistricting action, there's an equal and opposite reaction you have to do to another district. The 7th congressional district, which is currently represented by Democrat Carolyn Bordeaux, would be overwhelmingly Democratic and exist entirely within Gwinnett County. Now, another big change that's probably a little more relevant to Athens is that the 9th and 10th districts would change a little bit, and it would put Athens-Clark County within its own congressional district instead of being split up like it currently is now. And technically, the way the lines are drawn, 9th District Representative Andrew Clyde doesn't live in the 9th District under this map, but the Constitution allows you don't have to live in the district. So it's unclear if these will be the final lines, but it's also unclear if Representative Clyde would stay in the 9th or if he would try to run in the new 10th district that he lives in.
So speaking of that, I mean, you just said it's sort of unclear, but how likely do you think it is that Athens will become just one congressional district?
Well, it remains to be seen. You know, the boundaries that are in there, Athens-Clark is not exactly close to the border. The new 10th district includes Elbert, Madison, and Jackson counties, but it is potentially likely that Athens-Clark would stay whole in that regard. Over the summer, during the redistricting town halls that were put throughout the state, there was one in Athens, and a lot of citizens asked that Athens be kept whole as much as possible at the congressional and state level. And because of the population of the county, it's very easy for that to work in a congressional capacity because you'd have to add about 763,000 or so Georgians make up a congressional district. And since Athens-Clark, according to the census, has 128,000, well, yeah, it's easy to keep it whole. But we will still likely see Athens-Clark split up into 3 state house districts and 2 state senate districts unless something drastically changes there.
Well, let's talk more about the 2 Georgia house districts, the 117th and the 119th. Both of which touch Athens and have elected new representatives several times in recent years. Will Georgia House Republicans prioritize making those seats more secure for their party, or do they have other fish to fry?
Well, if you look at the bigger picture, Republicans still control the state House and the state Senate, and the maps that they create are going to reflect that. But over the last decade, the demographics and politics of parts of Georgia have changed. And so South Georgia and Southwest Georgia has lost a lot of population. So there's probably going to be fewer representatives from that area because just there isn't the mass to support the same number of seats. But some of the areas that have grown the most have been Atlanta's northern exurbs and really around the Athens-Clark area, you know, Oconee County and Walton County and Jackson County in particular have seen a lot of population growth. So it's possible that the seats that you lose in South Georgia, you gain in Atlanta's northern and eastern exurbs and the surrounding areas. So the strategy will probably be to shore up the existing districts that you do have so that you maybe have a narrower majority, but it's a majority that will last the entire decade through the population changes and through any sort of political shifts.
Stephen Fowler is a political reporter at Georgia Public Broadcasting. Thanks so much, Stephen, for bringing this information to our listeners today.
Thank you for having me.
There's plenty of data. Science about how vaccines for COVID-19 save lives. But for many, science is not the first place they turn to when making decisions about whether or not to be vaccinated. For some, the case for vaccination has to be a religious one. GPB's Grant Blankenship has more.
By the time Marlis Thomas found his way to a vaccination event outside a hair salon in Columbus, he had already spent time in a hospital with COVID and double pneumonia.
And it's just by the grace of God that I'm still here, because COVID itself was just taking people out.
Thomas is a pastor at Ebenezer Baptist Church in Hertzboro, Alabama, about 30 miles west of Columbus. He says even after being hospitalized, he really wrestled with whether or not to be vaccinated.
Because it's either you're going to trust God or you ain't going to trust God.
Meanwhile, visiting the same clinic was Dr. Cameron Webb of the White House COVID response team.
Hey, man, how's it going?
And so they talked.
Good, man. See, my father-in-law's a pastor. We spent a lot of time in the Word, and he's had so many folks in his church, he's a rural community, just talking about the virus and the vaccine, and where is God in that conversation, you know?
This one's hard because actually I have conversations like that within my own family.
That's Darlene Flaming, professor of religion at Mercer University. She says Marlis Thomas is not alone. For a lot of Southern Protestant Christians, there can be a tendency to say,
I'm going to pray and God will heal me. And, you know, if God doesn't, then it was just my time.
But since the summer, Flaming has been working with college students who in turn work with faith leaders to shift that thinking. The program is called Faith in the Vaccine. She says the first step in the conversation is listening to and respecting faith. After that, she says there is one obvious place to begin talking.
We'll talk about loving one's neighbor as oneself. I mean, certainly you see this in the Christian scriptures, but also in other scriptures too.
In the Gospel of Mark, loving your neighbor is the second most important commandment Jesus gives, right after enjoining his followers to love God. But the idea is central to most world religions.
So then it might be that out of an ethic of love, of care for others, that one would be willing to say, oh, well, I know God's got me.
But if I get vaccinated,
maybe I can do things to help my neighbors.
Like slow the spread of a highly communicable, deadly virus. That, the reasoning goes, is an act of love. So far, this tack has helped Flaming students find collaborators in both Latino and Black religious communities, and this has led to a number of vaccination events. But Flaming says so far her students have not found a pastor in their third community of focus, the White Evangelical Church. That could be because in that community, vaccination is often wrapped up with the theology of personal liberty.
America exists because we came here so we could worship Jesus Christ freely. That is why our founding fathers created this nation.
That's Georgia candidate for governor Candace Taylor at an anti-vaccine protest in Macon in August. According to a recent survey from the Kaiser Foundation, white evangelicals like Taylor remain the least vaccinated minority in the country.
This nation belongs to Jesus. It does not belong to communism.
Back in Columbus, Pastor Marlis Thomas has come to a different conclusion after his stretch in the hospital COVID ward.
The right people was at the right place at the right time, helping me through what I need to get through, along with God.
And so after realizing he'd never have survived COVID alone, Thomas says he'll keep trusting God by going ahead and getting vaccinated. For GPB News, I'm Grant Blankenship in Macon.
On Fresh Air, you'll hear the questions you wish you could have asked to people like Tom Kenny, the voice of SpongeBob SquarePants.
Did it help to hear what your voice sounded like on helium? Did you learn something about your voice you didn't know before?
Yeah, I learned that I don't really need the helium.
Because it's pretty easy to flick that switch and go right up there.
The most interesting people in show business on Fresh Air.
This is Athens News Matters. I'm Alexia Ridley.
And I'm Chris Shoup. If you live in Northeast Georgia, you've probably seen a Joro spider. More likely, you've probably seen dozens of them recently. They're big, brightly colored, and lately, they seem to be everywhere.
Once you start looking, they're all over. I've had probably 200 in our yard, which is a third of an acre.
That's Matt Elliott, Assistant Chief of the Wildlife Resources Division of the Georgia Department of Natural Resources.
You know, I've noticed them in the past, but this year seems to be the year that their population has really exploded.
Native to East Asia, Joro spiders were first discovered in Georgia in 2014, and they've been spreading and expanding in population ever since, reaching at least 25 counties in northeast Georgia, according to the University of Georgia Center for Invasive Species and Ecosystem Health. This has some ecologists like Elliot concerned about the Joro's impact on the area's ecosystem.
You know, I think basic ecology of invasive species would tell you that especially a predator like that that is increases in such vast numbers in such a short period of time is probably having some effect on the ecosystem.
But some entomologists like Nancy Hinkle, professor of entomology at the University of Georgia, welcome the new species.
I think we should look at them as good creatures serving a useful purpose and allow them to do their thing for a few years until, again, we can see just what kind of impact they're going to have on the ecosystem.
But more on that in just a moment. First, how do you know the spider in your yard is a Joro and not, say, a yellow garden spider?
Yes, let's know what creature we're talking about. The Joro is a larger spider, and she's usually quite noticeable. She's dramatically colored. She's got a red spot on the end of her abdomen.
Look for bright yellow backs with horizontal bluish-green bands and black legs with yellow bands. The males are brown and much smaller. And then there's the spider's web, perhaps the most memorable part of the Joro experience for anyone who's bumbled into one.
If you get the light just right, it's truly magnificent. They look like they're spun of fine gold.
But they're also quite strong and pretty sticky.
I described them as being kind of somewhere between silly string and fishing line.
Whether a Joro web is considered gorgeous or just gross is a point at which Elliot and Hinkle differ. They do agree on one thing, however. It catches nearly everything. For Hinkle, the web eliminates pests.
All those thrips, all those aphids, all those moths that are laying eggs in my garden and eating up my tomato plants, anything that gets caught in the spider web no longer can reproduce, can no longer contribute to the population. So to me, that's a good thing. It's like a giant glue board. It's removing pests from the atmosphere.
Elliot contends that it isn't just garden pests or the oblivious public radio host, like yours truly, that get caught in the webs.
They're a generalist predator. They're eating the insect population at large. So there's, you know, besides mosquitoes and stink bugs, there's certainly a lot of other things that they're eating. And there have never been spider predators in that kind of abundance that I've ever seen around here.
Hinkle says that those giant webs could be taking prey away from native spiders. And that's a major concern for Elliot.
And there's a lot of anecdotal evidence that the yellow garden spiders or the writing spiders have declined as the Joros have increased in abundance. There's not any hard data on that yet, but there's enough for me to think that that's probably true.
And a simplified ecosystem is a less resilient ecosystem.
It's just a loss of our native biodiversity. It's part of the character of the area, and you end up with a simplified ecosystem with less diversity.
Hinkle agrees, but says more study is needed.
They're new to this area, so we don't know that much about them. This will be something that graduate students will be working on in the future, answering questions like this. When do they lay their eggs? Do they overwinter as eggs? So many questions for which we don't yet have answers.
Nancy Hinkle and Matt Elliott both agree that there's not a lot to be done about the Joro population, at least as a regional phenomenon. There's just too many of them. But Elliot says in your own yard, there may be something you can do.
You know, I've taken the approach of getting rid of them in my yard. And I have seen some response of some of the natives. You know, maybe we can keep a little bit of what we want around if we create that space for them.
There's still a lot of research to be done into Joros, as Nancy Hinkle notes. But it appears that the adults will be gone at least temporarily pretty soon. And until then, keep an eye on where you walk.
Social workers tackle our toughest social problems, often working side by side directly within communities. But COVID-19 social distancing practices have made that difficult, and many social workers have adjusted by finding new, innovative ways to solve problems with technology. Earlier this week, I explored these challenges with the Associate Dean of the University of Georgia's School of Social Work, Orion Mowbray. Here's our conversation. 5 years ago, the American Academy of Social Work and Social Welfare designed a project called the Grand Challenges of Social Work. Can you tell us a little bit about the project?
Sure, yeah. So this is a project that was developed by the organization you said with the idea that the grand challenges that were developed were things that would guide our profession over the next 10 years. They tend to focus on ensuring healthy development by addressing mental, emotional, and behavioral health problems, building relationships to end violence, and most importantly, harnessing technology for social good to help more individuals and communities.
Technology has become an increasing part of everyone's jobs because of the pandemic and social distancing practices. How have social workers adapted to using technology during the pandemic?
This was a big challenge for social work. Historically, our profession has not been entirely technology-oriented for several good reasons. People in the communities we tend to work in may not have access to the most up-to-date technologies. Also, social work often requires us to be present in the communities that they live in. Fortunately, we've made pretty good strides in the last few years in terms of researching how to best use technology in the profession.
But your profession is one where, as you said, being in person, being in their environment really gives you sort of additional information. Do you think the adaptations social workers have made because of the pandemic will continue beyond the pandemic?
Well, I'm hopeful for a mix. I think despite the significant costs for humanity associated with what we've all been through for the last 18 months, there are some learning tools that have come out of this process. And I'm hoping that we'll have a chance to reflect on what worked best and how, and integrate them into our everyday use.
Can you talk specifically about some of what's happening at UGA with technology and social work?
Across our curriculum, as we train the next generation of social workers, we've integrated practices and trainings to better help our graduates understand what will be expected of them when they enter the field. And at this point, I think there is a high expectation that they'll be capable of using technology, including things like telehealth, in their everyday practice.
Your research focuses on substance use treatment. What are the unique technology challenges social workers in this area face?
A lot of my work focuses on persons with substance use problems in the criminal justice system. And what we often find is that the substance use treatment providers within a given region have limited communication. So this presents a real problem in terms of information sharing, access to records, and knowing how to intervene when it's necessary, both on the substance use side and the criminal justice side. So a lot of the work that I've done tends to focus on how do we get to a place where people can share that information in a better way. That can include things like making requests for persons to complete information records releases so that information can be shared electronically between organizations. So we begin to understand how technology can be used to improve the health and wellness of people throughout the state of Georgia.
Thank you so much for giving us a few minutes of your time today.
Yeah, thank you so much.
Orion Mowbray is the Associate Dean at the School of Social Work.
Finally today, let's talk about blue jeans. Whether they're skinny, boot cut, or flared, brand new, or a pair we've had for decades, it's safe to say that we all have a pair or two of these iconic American garments. However, the textile industry, and specifically jeans manufacturers, are not the most environmentally friendly makers out there. Your favorite pair of jeans comes with a measurable environmental cost.
But that cost could be lessened. Dr. Sergei Menko, professor of fiber and polymer science at the University of Georgia, along with Dr. Raha Saremi, Dr. Suraj Sharma, and Smriti Rai, have created a new eco-friendly way to dye jeans.
This process soaks 90% of natural indigo into the fabric, completely eliminating the use of harmful chemicals compared to current methods.
The current, most widely used dyeing method requires 8 or more dips using 50 to 100 liters of water. But Dr. Menko's process glues the color in place with just one dip. Here's Dr. Menko.
In this way, we save a lot of water because each deposition step in traditional technology requires a lot of water. And secondly, we don't use chemicals. In this way, we have much less environmental pollution with our technology.
Although the new technology still needs to be commercialized, it's a viable option for making the denim industry more sustainable. And the work of Menko and his colleagues won second place in the 2021 CADE Prize for Innovation last week.
You've been listening to Athens News Matters from WUGA News. Our producers are Martin Matheny, Gene Davis, Devin Zwald, Kara Nelson, and Abby Buston. The opinions expressed on this broadcast do not necessarily reflect those of WUGA or the University of Georgia.
Don't forget to visit WUGA.org to listen to any of this week's stories or our previous stories again. And we'd love for you to follow us on Facebook and Twitter. We're at WUGA-FM. For Alexia Ridley, I'm Chris Shoup. Thanks for listening to Athens News Matters from WUGA News. Enjoy the rest of your weekend and be safe out there. We'll be back next Friday with more from Athens News Matters.